Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Endless Blue by Wen Spencer, narrated by Peter Lerman. 1. Out of the Blue. At first, Captain Mikhail Ivanovich Volkov couldn't comprehend what he was looking at in the cavernous dry dock of Plymouth Space Station. From the observation window where Mikhail stood, the thing tethered in zero gravity looked like a rough pebble, or, considering the vastness of the dry dock, a boulder. The rock's bottom was bulbous and rough, as if it had been scooped out of bedrock, but halfway up the edges, smooth to gently curved walls. Only when he forced himself to look at the upper section by itself did he realize what the boulder truly was. A ship's warp drive embedded in rock. Judging by the housing protruding out of 20 meters of stone, the drive was from a very large ship, most likely a carrier. Its manifolds were buried somewhere in the stone, which didn't make sense. An impact hard enough to bury the drive that far into rock should have shattered it. The walls of the housing, however, seemed intact, although coated with a white material. One thing was sure. The misshapen rock was why his ship, the Svoboda, had been requested by the United Colonies to leave the front lines and jump halfway across human space. A new Washington lieutenant, sergeant, and two Reds had escorted him through Plymouth Station security. They bristled with resentment that the UC required them to let a Russian like him on board and refused to answer any of his questions. Since they were giving him the silent treatment, he was ignoring them while they all waited for the UC officer. Said officer was taking his time. A tentative, "Misha?" made Mikhail turn, surprised that anyone would be calling him by his childhood name. The Minister of Defense, Andrew Hayward, was immediately recognizable from his square frame and solid, heavy-jawed face. Like most people from his childhood, Hayward was shorter than Mikhail remembered, coming only to Mikhail's shoulder. The defense minister cocked his head and looked uncertain of Mikhail's identity, even though he was the only one in a Novaya Rus militia uniform in sight. Behind him, the Washingtonians seemed stunned that the minister was on a first-name basis with him. Obviously, they hadn't put much thought into Mikhail's family name. "Minister Hayward, it's been a long time." Hayward grunted slightly. "You don't look like your father." Some people avoided the labels of father and son when discussing Mikhail and his father, since they were both clones of the same man, the legendary Tsar Viktor Pyotrovich Volkov. They made the mistake of thinking Ivan and Mikhail were both figureheads that the Loyalist Party created. They somehow discounted the fact that Tsar Ivan personally forced the Novaya Rus Empire into the United Colonies before Mikhail was born. Hayward, though, had dealt with Ivan enough to know that Ivan ruled everything and everyone with an iron hand. That meant everything about Mikhail's life, including his inception, fell under Ivan's control. Biologically, Ivan was Mikhail's twin brother, but in every other manner, Ivan was his father. So why the hesitation? Had Hayward originally meant that Mikhail didn't look like Victor? Possibly. Hayward would also know that both Ivan and Mikhail disliked being compared to their famous original. Mikhail tapped his crooked nose. "It's the nose. I broke it in the academy, and I smile more than my father. Crow's feet, laugh lines, those kinds of things." Hayward eyed him. "I wouldn't have thought it would make that much difference, but I suppose it does. Ivan always looks like he has a lemon shoved up his ass. Your hair is darker, too." "He spends more time in the sun." "Ah." Hayward gave a slight grunt of understanding, adding a wave toward the black of space beyond the dry dock's great soap bubble shield. "Nope, not much sun up here." Hayward dismissed the Washingtonians. Their conversation was going to be private, or at least that was how Hayward wanted it to appear. "You took heavy losses during your last intel run?" Hayward led off with questions instead of explaining where the drive came from. more proof that it was going to be tied somehow to Mikhail's future. How do you stand now? Are you at full strength? Had Hayward been trying to get Mikhail to lower his guard? The truth was that while Hayward had been at the palace often, Mikhail would not have called him a friend of the family. My ship is fully repaired, Mikhail said carefully. My Red Commander is picking up replacements for the men I lost. Hayward nodded blandly, but there was a tightening around his mouth as if the news was bad. Any time you take on large numbers of Reds, you end up with dominance issues. So Hayward was going to want him to ship out immediately. I have no concerns. Mikhail put steel into his words. Most captains made the mistake of pulling replacements from multiple creches, which resulted in all the Reds vying with each other. Mikhail deliberately tapped only one creche at a time, so the replacements already had an established dominance order. The infighting was kept to a fight between the leader of the creche Reds and his foster brother, Turk, who was his Red commander. Hayward waited for him to add more, but Mikhail wouldn't weaken his position by trying to justify his statement. Instead, Mikhail took command of the discussion, pointing to the drive. Where did that come from? It warped into local Plymouth space 78 hours ago. A crew went out to clear it, and when they realized what it was, they brought it in. 78 hours. Allowing for Hayward's travel time to Plymouth meant that Hayward's choice of the Svoboda wasn't based on convenience. There were many ships closer. Come on, Hayward said. I want you to see this firsthand. As they stepped into the confines of the airlock, Hayward said, You'll have to get your nose fixed before taking over for your father. It makes you look too much like a Red. Mikhail nodded to the last statement. That was what he liked about his skewed nose. At the time, he merely just didn't want to look like Victor or his father anymore. That it gained him respect from the battle-torn Reds was now the main reason he didn't get it fixed. Besides, he wasn't sure he wanted to inherit his father's position. Considering the mess he'd made of his life, it was also unclear if the Loyalist Party would allow him. That was the whole point of him being the captain of a warship. If he became a military hero, his early misadventures might be overlooked. The airlock opened to the dry dock, which was under pressure, but still at zero gravity. A skimmer was waiting to take them across the vast floor, touching down and locking into place just short of the rocky edge. The dry dock's floodlights cast multiple shadows of the drive on them, layering them in shades of gray. The rock gave way to fist-sized objects, seemingly organic in nature, clustered tight together. The creatures reeked like dead fish. Under their stench was another odor, something elusively familiar, but he couldn't name it. The band of organisms was 3 meters wide, ending in a durasteel housing, which was coated with a rough layer of white powder. A fine grit drifted in a halo around the base. Mikhail moved closer to scoop a handful of grit out of the air. He rubbed it between his fingers. This is sand. This rock is coral. Mikhail recognized the underlying smell now, the briny scent of something long soaked in the salt water. The white powder could be salt crusting the steel. 3 different species of coral, all trademarked, which made them Earth species adapted for terraforming purposes. So far, we picked 32 life forms off the housing. Other than the coral, we couldn't identify any of them. Mikhail had seen what re-entry on an Earth-like planet would do to most spaceships. Gravity and wind shear tattered ships into pieces, which tumbled down into the blue, at first like pebbles dropped into water, and then the pieces would start to smoke. Finally, they flashed to fireballs of molten steel, becoming a firestorm. Mikhail shook off the memory, focusing on the mystery at hand. There were no scorch marks on the drive housing, which begged the question of how it got into an ocean without undergoing re-entry. And where was the rest of the ship? What ship is it from? Mikhail asked. Hayward took out a VID scanner, aimed it at the drive, and activated it. After punching in his security code, he held it out wordlessly to Mikhail to read its screen. Wormhole Drive, serial number WDU290843, installed in Jupiter-class carrier UCS Fenrir. A Jupiter-class was the largest spaceship that the United Colonies made. Years went into its construction, and it had a crew numbering in the thousands. That explained Hayward's involvement. Why had Mikhail been called in? He was Novaya Rus militia, technically not part of the United Colonies force. It was only a matter of goodwill that he responded. The name Fenrir rang no bells, so it had been destroyed prior to him entering the military. Considering the coral growth, it might have been lost even before Mikhail was born, as the United Colonies had been fighting the Nephrim years before the Novaya Rus Empire joined the effort. "What happened to the Fenrir?" Mikhail asked. "It vanished 10 years ago," Hayward scrolled down. "We assumed it misjumped, and the evidence partly supports that. The second-to-last entry shows that a miscalibration took them to zero." Mikhail frowned at the entry. A wormhole drive created a tunnel from one point in space to another. Any positive number would put them in normal space. Zero was the theorized null that the tunnel passed through. The nowhere between two points of somewhere. While the drive might think that the Fenrir went nowhere, it obviously went someplace. If Fenrir didn't simply cease to exist, standard protocol for a ship of its size was to radio High Command its new location. Even if it somehow warped into a planet's gravity well, there should have been still time to launch its life pods. There would have been a chorus of distress signals. And what of the Fenrir's shuttles, which were quite capable of lifting off a planet and warping home? Why hadn't at least one survived to contact High Command? A ship of the Fenrir's size couldn't vanish without misjumping. Since the wormhole drive generated the warp field, it was the only piece of the spaceship that couldn't be left behind when the rest ceased to exist. The two facts directly conflicted.
"Were there signs of tampering to the engine?" Mikhail asked. "Every test we've run indicates that those are the actual coordinates that the Fenrir went to."
Hayward hadn't denied, though, that there had been tampering. In another man, Mikhail might have ignored the disparity between his question and Hayward's answer.
"The coordinates are impossible," Mikhail tried to press him into answering.
Hayward held up his VID scanner.
"This is proof that they're not impossible, just improbable."
Mikhail scowled at the VID scanner's screen. The last entry was the coordinates for Plymouth Station. Regardless of wherever the Fenrir might be in truth, they'd chosen to return their engine to a recently commissioned UC space station deep in friendly territory. A good trick when they'd been missing for 10 years.
"What explanation did the Fenrir give when it sent back its engine?"
Hayward made a sound of disgust.
"Everything that came back with it only makes the mystery bigger."
There was a guideline set up circling the engine. Hayward hooked onto the guideline and let it arch him around the rock.
"Careful on the coral, it's sharp."
As they circled the base, it was easy to see that the coral had been cut by the sudden intrusion of the warp field. The field had smoothly sheared the coral off as it shifted somewhere to nowhere to Plymouth Station. The massive steel beams of the support struts had been cut as cleanly as the rock. On the other side of the boulder was something even more amazing. A boat. It floated in the zero gravity, anchored in place with mooring lines. It was about 25 meters long. Its steel wedge-shaped hull was painted deep blue, with its upper decks a crisp white. Lettering on the stern identified it as the Swordfish. With the exception of a heavy laser cannon turret on its bow, it seemed a simple fishing boat.
"What's that doing here?" Mikhail asked. "It came with the engine. There was a large amount of frozen seawater in this boat. We cleared the ice before it melted and made a mess of everything."
Had the Swordfish's crew been aboard when it suddenly found itself in deep space? Had they been standing on the open deck, below where it might be airtight as well as watertight? Or had they gone through the broken windows of the bridge?
Any crew? Mikhail asked. None that survived. Hayward pointed his VID scanner at the boat, entered his security code, downloaded whatever data the boat was holding, and held the VID scanner out to Mikhail. Torpedo, serial number T49350483542, released to UCS Swordfish. This got odder and odder.
It doesn't have any launch tubes for torpedoes, Mikhail pointed out. It's using the torpedo's fission engine as its power unit. A converter redirects the power to a crude electrical engine. Said electrical engine must be connected to the propeller, now drifting several feet off the floor of the docking bay.
Look at the armory time stamp. Mikhail frowned at the date that followed the release data.
Have you verified that?
Yes. The Swordfish picked up this torpedo from the Fort Armstrong Armory 10 months ago.
The name on the boat did not bode well for the fate of the Swordfish. Still, Mikhail asked,
Where's the Swordfish? The Swordfish was a torpedo ship. It disappeared a week after picking up this torpedo. We assumed it was destroyed by enemy fire.
So, two ships, both lost, both in the same place.
Yes, Hayward said.
This is obviously the work of humans.
Mikhail pointed to the boat.
It follows maritime conventions started on Earth. Based on the name, I suspect the crew of the Swordfish.
That's true. Come.
A second guideline ran up the side of Fenrir's warp engine. It lifted them up the steep side and guided them down to a safe landing on the top of the housing. The access hatch was open. Plymouth Station had run a string of work lights into the cramped, dark interior. Mikhail had never worked with an engine this large, but 4 years of warp field theory at the academy had taught him the fundamentals. What had been attached to, and in some places replaced, the standard equipment was a collection of bizarre things. He hesitated in calling them machines, although that was what they seemed to be. One looked more like cotton candy than anything mechanical.
They were modifying the engines, Hayward said. It's not clear if the modifications were completed. We've analyzed as much as we can without removing anything. Obviously, the engine still creates a warp field. What they were modifying it to do is still unclear.
Mikhail could think of two uses. Have you considered that this may be a trap, that it might warp Plymouth Station to Fenrir's location, or destroy it?
We've taken out the power core and scanned for secondary power sources. We've also checked it for all known explosives.
The warp engine, the alien devices, and the Swordfish all seemed like pieces from different puzzles. Hayward obviously wanted Mikhail's help in solving them all.
You want me to recreate the Fenrir's Miss Jump, Mikhail said. You want me to find her.
I'm basically committing political suicide, tapping the Tsar of Novaya Rus's only child for a mission like this. Believe me, I considered every option before settling on you.
Why me?
To start with, there's your ship, the Svoboda. As a frigate, she can enter a planet's atmosphere, fly at low altitude if needed, land and take off. As an intelligence-gathering ship, the Svoboda has the experience and the needed equipment to move undetected while searching for the Fenrir. Personally, you were raised landside, which means you understand wind and weather. Also, you're Novaya Rus militia. It might not be coincidence that both of these ships are from New Washington. We might be looking at sabotage.
Over the course of 10 years?
We've lost a lot of ships to missed jumps. It's been considered unavoidable since jumps are often made by damaged ships under heavy fire. That might not be the case.
I see.
And then there's your Red Commander.
Mikhail turned sharply to frown at Hayward.
What does my brother have to do with this?
Brother? My God, Volkov adopted your Red?
No.
Mikhail refused to explain more.
It still amazed Mikhail that otherwise intelligent people couldn't see that it was morally wrong to treat another as inferior just because of the circumstances of their birth. If his father was going to bring two children into the universe via bioengineering, the fact that one was genetically related and the other wasn't shouldn't have made a difference. Turk should have had every advantage that he had. God knows his father could afford it. At least, they'd been equal in Ivan's affections, which was to say, none.
How does Turk figure into this? Mikhail repeated. Perhaps it would be better to show you.
Mikhail had seen enough reds exposed to hard vacuum to differentiate the body from a normal human. Reds were genetically adapted so they could change and adapt to extreme conditions. While a red could survive 10 times longer than an unadapted human, eventually the cold and vacuum of space would kill them. The red's claws, arms, and chest were covered with blood. Sometimes a red would claw up his face and throat during the last moments of asphyxiation. There were no wounds, however, on the red.
Who did he kill?
These two? Webster uncovered 2 purely human males. All 3 wore natural cotton fabric fashioned into worn, ill-fitting, and weather-beaten clothing. There was neither rank insignia nor indication that the clothes were uniforms of any sorts.
Who are they?
We can't establish an ID for either human. Moreover, the red serial number isn't in our system.
Someone is cranking out unregistered reds.
We need to investigate this, Hayward said. Risk everything and zero out in a jump. Find out what's out there.
We?
Mikhail stifled a snort. Hayward meant the Svoboda, alone.
You're talking about the suicide run.
We have to do this, Misha. 2 of our ships in the same spot can't be a coincidence. We're looking at an organized effort. Currently, all of our defenses are designed to counter the physical capabilities and limitations of the Nephrim. If the Nephrim are mass-producing Reds with the intent to use them against us, we'll be lost. We've lost one creche after another, so our production is down. And I don't have to tell you about how much stronger and faster a Red is compared to a human.
I know.
Growing up with Turk, he was well aware of it. Even though Turk was nearly 4 years younger than he was, his foster brother had been able to win any physical competition between them shortly after learning how to run.
Our fears are that the Nephrim have acquired enough of our technology and biological samples from our Reds to start creating them. This place, wherever it is, apparently lets them overwhelm our ships and hold them for some reason. We think it might be a training ground for their Reds. They could be teaching their Reds how to capture and disable our ships.
If that was the case, it would spell disaster for the human race.
If this was a simple in and out, then anyone could make the jump, Hayward continued. We need someone that can think outside the box, way outside, take on any situation and pull out a win.
In other words, the Volkovs' reputation for pulling things out of their butts preceded him. Mikhail ran his hand through his hair, combing his bangs back off his forehead, thinking furiously. Hayward's strength was that he outmaneuvered his opposition, staging hit-and-run meetings. He brought things to the table that the other side didn't expect, wasn't prepared for, and then arranged deals while holding the upper hand. This meeting was classic Hayward tactics. He slammed Mikhail with the huge mystery of the Fenrir's drive, dropped the bomb of impending doom for the entire human race, and then commanded that Mikhail go. The question wasn't whether Mikhail should go or not, but what Hayward was trying to keep him from seeing. Mikhail saw it then and let out his breath.
The Novaya Rus Empire is risking a great deal. For what? Mass production of Reds requires a creche. All of the lost creches belong to New Washington. If I find a creche, I will have to bring it back or destroy it, since production of Reds is down. It would make more sense to recover the creche. I'm not risking everything and then handing over anything I recover to New Washington.
I want anything I recover to be considered salvage, free and clear.
Don't be stupid, Mikhail. This is a UC military operation. Any property recovered during all UC activities reverts to the original owner.
Mikhail shook his head.
No. The Novaya Rus Space Force is part of the UC force under the terms of the treaty. Our privately funded militia, however, operates on a volunteer basis only with the UC. I can refuse this mission.
Yes, that was it. Hayward glowered at him.
If New Washington had a ship you thought had a chance at succeeding, you would have sent them. But you've already analyzed this, and I'm the only one that meets all the criteria needed for best success on this mission.
I can't waive away their rights to the Crescers.
Yes, you can. There is even precedent. The Catalina Superliner. Declare that anything I find is free for salvage, and I'll go.
Hayward worked his jaw, possibly chewing down things he knew he shouldn't say.
Fine. I'll have it posted within an hour. Here's a courier packet with everything you need to know for this mission.
2. Paradise Lost. Paradise was burning. The Tiger Tail came in from the night side of the planet, and the continent-wide fires glowed like a red eye in the night. Daylight came as a tear-blinding crescent as they pulled into orbit and took up a geosynchronous position over the day side. Thick layers of smoke obscured most of the destruction on the planet, but the remains of spaceships were raining down invisible contrails. Turk found it hard to count this as a human victory. He and Mikhail had visited Paradise when they were young. It had lived up to its name. Lieutenant Grigory Belokhorov lifted his hand to his ear and cocked his head, listening closely.
Commander Turk, we're finally getting a response from the planet. A minor spaceport says they're still operational. There are sellers liquidating their prides to pay for evacuation costs, but we have to come down to get the Reds.
Belokhorov turned for his orders, adding,
It will be a rough ride down.
Turk growled his irritation. Going down to the planet would make them more vulnerable, but the attack probably took out much of what could climb out of the gravity well.
Fine. Tell them we'll be there shortly, and then plan a path down. Wait for my mark.
Yes, sir.
Turk keyed open the security lock between the cockpit and the red pit. It was good to see that his veterans were lounging easily together, with no clear division into warring camps, no fresh blood, although some of the betas looked unhappy.
Suit up, Turk said. We need to land to pick up the replacements. We're going to treat this as a hot zone.
But the Nephrim's pulled out, Rabbit protested.
Turk cuffed the yearling to shut him up, lightly, because Rabbit was right. The runt of his litter, Rabbit was the cleverest Red Turk had. At his size, he had to be, else he wouldn't have survived the crash.
This may be a real sale, Turk explained, or it might be a ploy to lure down stupid bargain hunters with a spaceworthy ship.
So we might be fighting humans,
Smoke smiled, showing off his sharp teeth.
Yes, but only on my command, Turk said. Anyone disobeying orders will be left behind on this hellhole. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir, they roared back.
He suited up with them and checked their armor, and saw them locked into place.
Okay, Lieutenant Belokhorov, take us down.
As the shuttle bucked and rocked through re-entry, Turk closed his visor, shut his eyes, and blocked out the world. If he was going to be dealing with New Washingtonians, the more human he appeared, the easier his mission would be. Luckily, he was fluent in English, while a Kresh-raised Red would only know standard. The hardest part of passing as human was convincing his own soul.
I'm human, he whispered as he forced himself to change. I'm human. I'm human. I'm human.
The spaceport's red pits were full. Turk stalked through them, glancing into the cages, looking for replacements.
In cruel irony, the Reds of Paradise had fought the Nephrim off their world, only to be locked up to be sold so their owners could flee. The healthiest would sell, but the sick and wounded ones would probably...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?